There is no hostage to fortune quite like the Nobel Peace Prize. Just as the peacemaker of today can often be the warmonger of yesterday, they can also be the warmonger of tomorrow. Abiy Ahmed, Prime Minister of Ethiopia, was 2019's Nobel Peace Laureate, recognised for finally ending Ethiopia's hostilities with its neighbour and former province, Eritrea. A year later, Abiy Ahmed's prize looks like one of the Nobel Peace Committee's hastier garlandings, along with those of Yasser Arafat, Aung San Suu Kyi, and Henry Kissinger. Ethiopia is at war with Tigray, a region in the country's north. The immediate cause was Tigray's decision to hold, in September, a local election despite being told not to by Abiy Ahmed's national government. Scheduled elections across Ethiopia were postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Behind that lies Tigrayan resentment of Abiy Ahmed's efforts to reduce Tigray's dominance of Ethiopia's national politics. Before Abiy Ahmed became prime minister, the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front had effectively governed all of Ethiopia for nearly two decades. It's hard to know exactly what is going on in Tigray right now. Phones are down, the internet is off. It's not much easier to speak to Ethiopians elsewhere in Ethiopia. Several people we asked to participate in this program responded that they were simply too scared. But of the news there is, none of it is good. How did Abiy Ahmed, supposedly a liberal reformer, end up here? And or was Tigray hoping to draw him into a fight? Are both sides running the risk of splitting Ethiopia, partly or entirely? And is there anything that can still be done to stop this? This is the Foreign Desk.
3 million people have been displaced in Ethiopia since Abiy Ahmed came to power. And that just doesn't bode well for the future of a country which was modelled very much on different ethnic groups having a lot of autonomy, but with a very authoritarian centre which kind of kept them in check.
It has been a process of political liberalisation. There is a great deal of tension and friction between the different political entities in Ethiopia. A lot of it centred around the federal system and issues of ethno-regional autonomy, and it's been a failure to craft a new political consensus that has led to this really serious conflict we now have in the north.
The calculation in Addis Ababa is that if they can subdue what they consider is the core foundation of ethno-nationalism in Ethiopia, not just in Tigray, but also providing support to the rebel groups in Oromia, all ethno-nationalists across the country, in the short term, there might be a lull of violence.
Welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by BBC Africa editor Mary Harper and Adam Cassie Abebe, who is a political security and governance analyst. Welcome both to the show. Mary, I'll start by asking you about what is happening in Tigray. It's obviously very difficult to know for certain because the government in Addis Ababa is doing everything it can to make sure as little information gets out as possible. But we do have reasonably well-sourced reports by now suggesting that the death toll from the fighting already runs into the hundreds. How severe does the fighting appear to be?
The fighting appears to be severe. For example, the head of the Air Force said on Wednesday that airstrikes were going to continue. Fuel and weapons depots have been attacked. The fact that we've got thousands of civilians fleeing the area into neighbouring Sudan suggests that the violence is intense. It is very difficult to get accurate figures. I mean, the federal government says at least 500 Tigrayan regional forces have been killed, and we're hearing of heavy casualties on the federal side as well. But it is very, very difficult to get information because communication lines are cut to Tigray. Sometimes I do get through to a journalist who's based there who can give information from the capital, Mekele, but even he is finding it difficult to find out what's going on in other parts of the territory. But from what we can tell, the fighting is intense and the effects on civilians is dramatic.
Adam, I want to go back to the beginnings of this crisis, which was this election that the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front decided to hold despite being told not to by federal authorities in Addis Ababa. When they went ahead with this election, is what we're seeing now the response they hope to provoke?
Well, in fact, the sources of the conflict actually go way back, and the elections were, so to say, the last straw. If you look at the rise of Abiy Ahmed, he came at a moment on the back of popular protests, and then the faction within the ruling party led by Abiy Ahmed and then his former president, Nema Magersa, used that popular protest to essentially organize a coup within the party, within the coalition. And the TPLF, which used to be the dominant force, did not want Abiy to come to power. And the contestation has been essentially brewing up since then. And the postponement of the elections at the national level, and then the defiance of the Tigrayan government to go ahead with the elections was really the last straw. But otherwise, the contestation has been brewing since the beginning of Abiy's rise to power.
But just to follow that up quickly, Adam, was this the TPLF trying to force some sort of decisive showdown with Addis Ababa?
It's very hard to say, because as strong as their army, their militias and all of them are, I don't think they actually want the battle. What they had hoped, I think, was that the contestations and their strength will force Abiy to the table and that way get some concessions. But I do not think that they actually wanted the confrontation itself to occur, because they have as much to lose from the confrontation as Prime Minister Abiy.
Mary, now that a confrontation does appear to be well and truly underway, what do we know about what kind of fight Tigray is able to put up against Ethiopia's military?
It's important when thinking about the Tigrayans. They don't make up a very big percentage of Ethiopia's population, probably about 6%. But when you think about the war that they fought in the 1980s and early 90s to dislodge the former dictatorial ruler Mengistu Haile Mariam, they are a group of people who are battle-hardened, they're used to fighting, given the fact that they also dominated the government since 1991 until the rise of Abiy Ahmed in 2018. They have military resources, they have military know-how. In some ways, you could almost say at least the older generation is part of a kind of military culture. So even if numerically they aren't going to be a match for the forces of the federal government, in terms of their sort of battle-hardened mentality and the fact that they did win a war against all odds in the 1990s, I think they're not going to be an easy force to deal with, even if maybe Abiy Ahmed from the air and elsewhere can smash their military resources. I think actually smashing the Tigrayan group who are opposed to his government is not going to be something that's easy to do, in spite of all this rhetoric that's coming out of Addis Ababa at the moment, basically saying that soon the TPLF leadership will be arrested and the situation will calm down. I find that difficult to imagine happening anytime soon.
Adam, is it clear that Abiy Ahmed does have a precise military objective in mind here? Is he thinking beyond merely steaming into Tigray and smashing the place up a bit in order to prove a point? Does he think Ethiopia can win this militarily?
I think at the moment they are really committed to winning the battle. I don't think it's a show of force to, you know, Abiy Ahmed. There is really very little that he can get out of them at the moment, and he really wants a decisive battle. But as Mary said, whether they can do that, it's very difficult. And, you know, even if it's 6% of the population, it's more than 6 million people. And they have tens of thousands, probably in the hundreds of thousands of soldiers in Tigray. Mm-hmm. And even if the federal government has that air dominance, it's very likely that the conflict will move into the cities, which will make it very hard to rely on the air force. I don't think this is just to scare them, because they have always said, okay, we want negotiation, we want dialogue. So if anything, it's the Tigrayans that want the federal government to come to the table, not the other way around.
Mary, it strikes me that this might be one of those occasions where contemplating the counterfactual might illuminate our present reality. Is it possible to say what might have happened if Tigray had gone ahead and held their election and the government in Addis Ababa had just said, fine, whatever, and ignored them?
I don't think it would have been possible for the government in Addis Ababa to just ignore the Tigrayans. They did, after all, hold an election that had been postponed by the federal government. It wasn't meant to happen because of the coronavirus pandemic. And the Tigrayans were just like, well, we're just going to hold our election anyway. That was in complete defiance to the authority of the central government. They'd also done some other things to annoy the Addis Ababa authorities. For example, they rejected a new leader of the military that had been sent up to govern that part of the military in Tigray. They were doing a lot of things to basically provoke Abiy Ahmed. So he couldn't have just folded his arms and let them continue. But at the same time, you know, for months now, the Tigrayans have been pressurized by the federal government. For example, resources have been slimmed down in terms of what resources they're getting from the center. And a lot of international powers, let's say, for example, the African Union, they've been saying the only way to deal with this problem, which is a very real problem, no one's denying that, is some kind of negotiations rather than just going after them militarily, which is obviously now creating a terrible problem there, especially for civilians who already live in a very difficult environment there that is pretty starved of resources.
We'll talk more in the second part of the program about what might happen next. But before we do that, just one final thought on where we are now. Adam, I'll ask you, how much popular support do you think Abiy Ahmed currently has among the rest of Ethiopia for this conflict with Tigray? And how likely is that whatever popularity it does have likely to last if there are further reports of Ethiopian casualties?
Perhaps it's better to measure popularity in terms of the hatred there is for the TPLF in Tigray. As I said, the TPLF was in power for 2.5 decades. They led an authoritarian rule, and there's a perception that their system benefited a few Tigray elites in economically, politically, and also the security sector. So there's a lot of hatred to what the TPLF represents in Ethiopia's past. If you measure it in that regard, there is indeed a lot of popularity. It's very hard to say exactly. And as you can imagine, the government is now engaged in a full-blown propaganda, not just to convince people, but to create a sense that this is legitimate and whip up popularity for the federal government. So I think I would measure it perhaps more in terms of the hatred for the past that the TPLF represents, much more than the support that Abiy has.
Adam Kasi-Abebe and Mary Harper, thank you both very much for the moment. We'll have more from you later in the show. Do stay with us. The conflict with Tigray may well end up being what defines Abiy Ahmed for a while to come at least. But what of that modernizing agenda which inspired such hope at home and abroad? Our next guest is William Davison, senior analyst on Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. He joins us from Addis Ababa. William, let's start with that Nobel Prize that Abiy Ahmed won just a little over a year ago. Is there any sense at all in which that has given him the cover for what he's doing now?
Whether you can call it, you know, giving him cover, I'm not so sure about. But of course, what does happen when you get the Nobel Peace Prize is it gives you a huge amount of prestige. And this was in a circumstance where Ethiopia's partners, as well as people in Ethiopia, had been hugely enthusiastic about Abiy Ahmed's arrival and these initial sort of aspirations that he expressed for rapid democratization and political liberalization. Getting the Nobel Peace Prize for the rapprochement with Eritrea and these initial promising moves impacted the transition in a significant way. But it was just one part of the way the international community responded so enthusiastically and then really invested in Abiy's administration and ultimately his vision for Ethiopia.
You're quite right in pointing out that he arrived in power portrayed as this liberal reformer that there was a great deal of excitement about. Those headline reforms he made initially, releasing political prisoners, freeing up the press to an extent, a year or so later, how lasting and meaningful do those reforms seem to have been?
Look, we could see them as the initial or the first phase of what was supposed to be a transition to multi-party democracy, but one which is obviously in a lot of trouble now. Just a quick point, it was an acceleration of political liberalization. Significant political prisoners were already released before Abiy came to power by the former prime minister and after decisions by the ruling coalition. And I think to refer back to my description of that being the first phase, the problem broadly with this transition, despite the aspirations, there has been a failure to create a new political settlement in Ethiopia after the collapse of the old one, which was run by this coalition of regional ruling parties, pretty much dominated by the TPLF. It has been a process of political liberalization, but there was a great deal of tension and friction between the different political entities in Ethiopia. A lot of it centered around the federal system and issues of autonomy. an ethno-regional autonomy. And it's been a failure to craft a new political consensus that has led to this really serious conflict we now have in the north.
That plan he appeared to have, or that tendency appeared to have towards freedom of expression, freedom of the press, how is that holding up? Because it has struck us while we've been putting this show together that a few Ethiopian journalists have just told us flatly that they don't want to participate because they're frightened.
Yeah, well, what we've seen is because of that failure to create a new political consensus, because of all the controversy over the delayed election and sort of violence throughout this transition, what we've had essentially is the government moving against prominent opponents. Obviously, the government says that's because those opponents have committed crimes. But other people see this to a return to the use of the judiciary and of the law to criminalize something like legitimate political dissent or legitimate political actors. So if you have people now who are worried about having their say, it's because of those sorts of dynamics. And of course, we are now into a sort of wartime situation, essentially. Positions are hardening, there are signs of increasing intolerance, and that will make people increasingly afraid to speak their mind.
So is it more useful to think of this conflict with Tigray as a distraction or diversion from what he wanted his domestic agenda to be, or as actually part of his domestic agenda?
I would say that this conflict with Tigray is the clearest indication of the failure to craft a new political settlement and manage the fallout from the period of anti-government protests that led to significant political change in Ethiopia and the rise of the prime minister to power. Obviously, there was something of a power struggle within the regime with regards to the protests against the government. It brought a new government to power. Some people lost out, very much including Tigray's ruling party. Since then, despite a somewhat promising beginning, it has just been increasing political acrimony, leading to this electoral constitutional dispute this year. And that relates to these issues of autonomy and the federal system that I mentioned. And finally, that bitter political trajectory has led us into conflict.
Well, just as a final thought then, if we look away from this conflict with Tigray and back towards a more, I guess, ordinary peacetime domestic agenda, what seems to you to be important to Abiy Ahmed? If it wasn't for Tigray, what would he be hoping to be accomplishing?
The problem, as I see it, with the agenda is it is about a sort of vision and an aspiration, and it doesn't really knuckle down and tackle the details of Ethiopia's core problems. It's evident that Abiy Ahmed and those around him believe in enhancing Ethiopian unity. They believe in a more liberal economic model, and also to a large degree, they believe in some of the traditional orthodox trappings of liberal democracy in terms of sort of institutional pluralism and that type of thing. But the issue in Ethiopia is, you know, what is that balance of power between the federal government and the regional states? To what extent is it acceptable for politics to be organized along ethnic lines? These are the real fault lines running through Ethiopian politics. They go back into Ethiopia's imperial history as well as the federal era. They require really careful and extensive deliberation and ultimately a sort of nuanced compromise approach to finding, you know, some sort of middle ground that is acceptable to enough political actors. So far, this transition has been too aspirational. There have been too many mistakes made. And ultimately, the politics has been too turbulent and violent to allow that sort of discussion to take place.
That was William Davison, senior analyst for Ethiopia at the International Crisis Group. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Still with me are Adam Cassie Abebe and Mary Harper. In this part of the show, I want to try and take a look at where this conflict might be taking Ethiopia. Adam, I'll ask you first, is there any part of this which Abiy Ahmed hopes the rest of Ethiopia will take some kind of lesson from? Because Tigray, of course, is very much not the only part of Ethiopia which sees itself as having a regional identity of its own.
That's a very important point because for a lot of analysts, the contestation between Abiy Ahmed, the federal government, and Tigray is really ideological. Abiy Ahmed has emerged out of a political context where ethnicity was essentially the axis of organization. And he thinks that politics based on ethnicity has sort of served its purpose. And now we need to move as a country towards a more pan-Ethiopian politics. On the other hand, the TPLF is the most organized, the strongest force that believes still that Ethiopian politics should continue to be organized primarily along ethnic lines. So that ideological contestation. And the TPLF is the most organized. It has a government structure. It has an army to project that ideology. Abiy, if indeed this war, as he wishes it to be, ends quickly, there will indeed be areas in other parts of the country where, for instance, in Oromia, where Abiy hailed from, there is a movement, a much smaller scale, and does not enjoy a territory and an organized state structure, but it will indeed continue. And in fact, the fear among a large population group is that the victory against TPLF would mean that the ethnic-based politics might be ending. That's where the ideological foundations of this conflict are.
Mary, what do you think? Is there any danger, thinking ahead months, maybe years, that the centrifugal forces which can sometimes compel a nation to come completely apart are already winding up?
I think this situation in Tigray, however grave it is kind of blinding observers to what's been going on in other parts of Ethiopia for months now. It's not just in Tigray where there's a problem between the ethnic Tigrayans and the rest, as it were. If you look at Oromia, you've got a lot of ethnic violence there, sometimes between different political or clans of the Oromo people. You've recently had a massacre of another large ethnic group, the Amharas. Dozens of them were massacred. There's fighting going on between the Oromos and the Somalis. There's fighting going on between the Somalis and the Afars. There are all sorts of ethnic conflicts at the moment in Ethiopia over land, over resources, over grudges. And the situation in the country really is alarming, because even though Tigray is the kind of the bit that everybody's focusing on, there's a lot of other parts of the country where you've also got violence and mass displacement of people. 3 million people have been displaced in Ethiopia since Abiy Ahmed came to power. And that just doesn't bode well for the future of a country which was modelled very much on different ethnic groups having a lot of autonomy, but with a very authoritarian centre which kind of kept them in check. Now that the centre has become more chaotic and is trying to, as Abebe says, trying to impose a different, more sort of pan-Ethiopian model, it really is not finding it easy to impose itself on this country, which at the moment really in some ways seems to be imploding.
Adam, this is always the difficulty when any nation faces a nationalist insurrection, even if it's not one done through violence in any one of its regions, that the harder you try to clamp down on it or the harder you work to deter it, the more it seems to excite the desire for independence. How great a risk is there that what Abiy Ahmed is doing now is just going to encourage similar movements, if not necessarily as well-armed and well-organized as the TPLF elsewhere in Ethiopia?
In the long term, depending on the politics that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and his party wants to pursue, we might enter a new cycle, essentially, of conflict that ultimately could lead to the revival of ethno-nationalism. But I think in the short term, at least that's the hope, the calculation in Addis Ababa is that if they can subdue what they consider is the core foundation of ethno-nationalism in Ethiopia, not just in Tigray, but also providing support to the rebel groups in Oromia, all ethno-nationalists across the country, in the short term, there might be a lull of violence.
Mary, from where we are now then, is there a way out of this that everybody could potentially live with? Is there any prospect of a compromise between Tigray and Ethiopia proper? I know already that the TPLF have suggested peace talks, which so far at least Abiy Ahmed has said he's not interested in.
Yes, at the moment, the two sides seem to be so diametrically opposed to each other. Like you say, Abiy Ahmed has rejected calls for a ceasefire even though the Tigrayan leadership is saying that they would be happy to have talks. But at the same time, on Wednesday afternoon, the Tigrayan called on the whole population to mobilize. So they're also adopting a very sort of war talk kind of mentality. And it's very difficult to see how the two sides are going to reach any agreement. Also because, as Abebe was saying, sort of politically, ideologically, they're so far apart from each other. And it's going to be difficult to woo the Tigrayans over into this new Ethiopia that Abiy Ahmed proclaims. What will be interesting is to see how much of the Tigrayan population go along with their leadership, with the TPLF, and indeed how many people who are in the Ethiopian army, the federal army, who happen to be Tigrayan, what they're going to do. Are they going to side with the federal government, or some of them going to splinter off and go and join the Tigrayan regional forces? At the moment, it is very difficult to see how they are going to come to any kind of negotiated settlement. There's also problems to do with, for example, Eritrea. The Tigrayans are accusing the Eritreans of sending forces into Tigray. This has been denied vehemently, both by the federal government in Addis Ababa and by the Eritreans. But you will have regional powers who are also going to be perhaps slightly meddling in this situation, which isn't going to make things any easier.
Adam, is there any prospect that those external powers, though, among them those that Mary mentions, could actually help here in any kind of proper way? I mean, Abiy Ahmed himself has shown in a couple of arenas that he's quite keen on the idea of the outside interlocutor bringing peace and brokering deals, at least if that outside interlocutor is him. Is there anybody that he would be willing to deal with as some kind of mediator, whether it's the African Union or the United Nations?
So you are right. I think Abiy Ahmed has, at least in the beginning, sought to project himself as a peacemaker, not just in Ethiopia, but across the region. But when it comes to the conflict now in Ethiopia, any international involvement would be considered, at least in his own circles, as a failure for his forces and his politics. It will take more than his willingness to make him engage in a serious dialogue to solve the problem. And I don't think the African Union has the capacity to do that. Perhaps I think the combination of the African Union, the United States, and the European Union, and perhaps even China, if there's a collective effort, there may indeed be some fruit. But I think any singular actor will find it very difficult to convince Abiy to get involved and bring peace. And especially when he thinks, or at least that's what they are trying to do now, they are projecting a sense of victory and of a quick end to this conflict. And perhaps also, I think it's important to note that, you know, the focus obviously is on Abiy Ahmed, but within his party, he relies to a large extent on the Amhara branch of the ruling party. And the Amhara branch consider themselves as victims of a sense of Tigrayan expansionism. And there is land areas that are currently formally within the Tigray region, but the Amharas want back. And even if Abiy may be willing to negotiate, he would have to convince a huge part of his party to agree to any peace talks. So it's quite complex. And of course, as Mary indicated, Eritrea is involved. So far, even if there has been accusations of engagement in the Northern Front, there is no evidence yet. But especially if this conflict continues, if it takes longer, I think external involvement, whether to make peace or to make things worse, will be even more likely.
Adam Kasse Abebe and Mary Harper, thank you both very much for joining us. And that's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.